It was really exciting in the old days of Warner Brothers. We were the only cartoon studio in the center of a Hollywood movie lot. It was like being in the eye of a hurricane. The first great star of the talkies, Al Jolson, had his dressing room in our cartoon studio. I used to watch him put on his makeup. He filmed right across the alley from us.
I'm coming! Oh, God! I hope I'm not late! Billy! Don't you know me? It's a little baby! I'd walk a million miles, or 1 million miles, but my not me.
And the big Busby Berkeley musical numbers with hundreds of chorus girls were filmed next door. Wow. We even did some animation for Jimmy Cagney in a Busby Berkeley number. It's true, you know, that no other setting could have produced the same energy, the same style, and the same sense of humor in cartoons.
I got Larry Thomas waiting in your office to hear your story. Come on, boys.
We haven't got any story.
Tell him one anyway.
Okay.
I was willing to shoot Captain Reno, and I'm willing to shoot you. All right, Major, you asked for it.
Cagney and Bogart and other top Warner stars used to stick their heads in our windows to see how cartoons were made. And we sketched caricatures of them, which sometimes ended up in our films. We recorded our own lives in cartoon caricatures. Nothing was sacred. We've been going along for some time making cartoons, and then one day, Leon Schlesinger teamed me up with a new fellow named Tex Avery, and he sent us off to a beat-up old wooden building in the middle of the lot to make our own cartoons. We named it Termite Terrace that very first morning because the wood creaked and it groaned, and the walls were made out of pressed paper that you could put your fist right through. Sometimes we wished it was a little bit fancier. From the beginning, Termite Terrace was such a crazy place that some people refused to go there. But we had a ball. We made a satire of everything around us, and we really had a great time. We really got moving in the period from mid-depression until the end of World War II. This was the golden age of Warner Brothers cartoons, when we created almost all the great characters and story styles, including our greatest cartoon star, Bugs Bunny. During my first year at the studio, I did a series of sketches of a wascally wabbit who always outwitted the hunters. But it was several years before a bouncing baby bunny boy was born on the screen. As we got to know him better, his character developed greater wit, confidence, and sophistication. And like all growing boys, his appearance changed as time went by. What people loved most about Bugs Bunny was his lack of inhibition. What everyone else would like to do, he did. And he got away with it, too. In those days, we used up to 10,000 drawings for each 7-minute cartoon. Now, that's quite a difference from today's TV, where they use as few as 3,000 for an entire half-hour show. We made this first statue of Bugs to help my animators learn how to draw him from every angle. After all these years, this little gray wabbit is a little grayer, but he's still with me. We had to be our own models for Bugs Bunny's facial expression. Some people thought it might have been Groucho Marx's cigar that inspired Bugs's carrot. But the idea really came from Clark Gable and Capra's It Happened One Night. As Gable and Claudette Colbert were hitchhiking by the side of the road, Gable started chomping on a carrot. Now, as I looked at him, I didn't see Gable. All I saw was a big rabbit chewing on a carrot. We loved Hollywood, and Hollywood people loved our characters so much that in 1941 there was even an achievement award called the Elmer. That year it went to Frederick March and Ingrid Bergman. Bugs Bunny got his first Oscar nomination in 1941 for A Wild Hare. He didn't get his Oscar then, but by the end of 1944, we had skyrocketed up ahead of Disney, and Bugs Bunny was voted the number one box office favorite. In those days, being a cartoon star kept you in some pretty good company. Now, once the characters were set, the next important step was the storyboard conference with our gag men. You know, we tried to think up the wildest, the most impossible ideas imaginable. No idea was too outrageous. Some of our story ideas, such as the famous chase scenes, were inspired by the great silent comedians like Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd and the Keystone Cops. Of course, there was method to some of our madness. You see, we always acted out our characters' lives, first by ourselves, then with our pencils. It gave us a better feel for the way the characters moved. Sometimes we photographed real scenes, like this one, to use the settings in our cartoons. We photographed Bugs Bunny's table and carrot juice bottle for What's Cookin' Doc. That's my assistant, Mike Sassanoff, and Bob McKimson's brother, Tom, at the table. Most of the work, of course, took place back at our drawing board. Drawing of the model sheets, the sketching of the layouts and scenic backgrounds, the planning of the colors, and the acting out of the Oscar scene for What's Cookin' Doc. And then, when the whole scene was ready, our stars stepped into place. A finished color celluloid was traced from the animator's pencil sketches by the ink and paint artists. Each tracing had to be painted in by hand before it was ready for the animation camera. There aren't many of these original cells left, you know, because the material was so scarce during the Depression and war years that we had to wash them off and use them over again in the next cartoon. To make each of these cartoons took up to 6 months and cost over $20,000. Today, the same thing might cost up to $100,000. Now, this is our wonderful musical director, Carl Stalling. He added some of the funniest and punniest moments with his musical scores. As you'll see here, Porky's friend the ghost leaps into a whirligig action, disappears, ding, and here's the music that follows that action as written by Carl. After we finished shooting the animation, we went over to the sound stage where Carl and our 50-piece orchestra added the final touches. Every actor has to start someplace, and Tweety got his start as a little baby bird in a nest in my cartoon, A Tale of Two Kitties. This is Tweety's actual baby picture. Confidentially, I modeled it after my own naked baby picture. Now, in his first cartoon, Tweety was just a bit player. But when he said, "I thought I saw a pretty cat," the fan mail started to pour in, and we knew he had a star. Things rolled along beautifully for several years, and then all of a sudden, the censors stepped in and they said, "Hey, that bird looks naked!" So, we had to put yellow feathers on Tweety and make him a canary. But do you know, for all those years, nobody ever noticed that Porky never wore pants.
I've told you that we always acted out our characters' lives. Sometimes it was hard to know where their lives left off, but ours began. Some of us even took time for lunch.
Bugs, of course, was our greatest star. But you may not know that our first star was Porky Pig.
He was originated as part of a team called Porky and Beans and was the little fat boy in our cartoon version of the Little Rascals comedies. We thought Porky would be cuter and more lovable if we slimmed him down a bit. So we put him on a Weight Watchers diet and he became the character everyone knows today. This, of course, is how Porky ended up. Our next star became Porky's new teammate, Daffy Duck.
From Texas cartoon Porky's Duck Hunt, and our animation of him became a bit more subtle. All the voices and the sound effects were recorded over at the sound stage. The man of a thousand voices, Mel Blanc, became world famous as the voice of Bugs Bunny, but he couldn't stand carrots. One teeny bite and Mel sort of choked up. So we tried everything. Celery, turnips, even rutabagas. But nothing sounded like a carrot but a carrot. So in our recording sessions, Mel would bite the carrot and chew, say the line, and then quickly spit the carrot out into a tub that we kept there beside him.